KPCW News, time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. On the phone is Nate Larson with ABC4. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, we've got pretty nice weather shaping up for the weekend. A little bit of storminess to get through again today. We had some storms roll through overnight. Highs today, though, a little more comfortable. 85 still expected for Park City. Best chance of any moisture will be later this afternoon into the overnight hours. Chance of moisture hanging on. In fact, overnight, it's about a 40% chance. 56 for the overnight low. Into the weekend, we will see another storm system clip northern Utah that'll keep about a 20% chance of a thunderstorm in the mix for Saturday afternoon and evening before we clear out. So southwest flow should take over and dry us out into Sunday. So temperature-wise, not much fluctuation for Park City over the next several days, with mid-80s expected to continue Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday next week. We will have high pressure, though, keep us on the dry side of things early next week, so bring plenty of sunshine with more seasonal temperatures for the Wasatch back. And then as we get into the latter half of next week, we'll see more sunshine, but a warm-up in temperatures as high pressure that's situated to the southeast of us right now starts to lift.
Okay, we seem to have lost Nate. Nate, are you still there? Okay.
Today, partly. Oh, keep losing me?
Yep, you're back. You're back, Nate. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm not sure why we're cutting out. We're on Wi-Fi. But yeah, we've got Heber looking at temperatures. We're hot still today, 91. Partly cloudy skies with a chance of storms later this afternoon and evening. And then another threat on Saturday. Temperatures aren't going to change a whole lot in Heber into the weekend. We'll stay in the low 90s, overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s, with a gradual warm up to about 95 through the middle of next week. We're staying dry, though, after these storms today. Tomorrow, we'll have a nice dry stretch of weather settle back in for next week as well.
You know, Nate, I know we've been looking at some significant fire danger because of how dry it's been. Any sense of how much moisture we got last night in some in Wasatch counties?
I saw on the summit, was it, in fact, I still have it pulled up, I believe. It was a little over 0.2 inches at some of the higher elevations. For an actual reading, there's not a lot of weather stations in and around Park City that update, but there were areas at Point of the Mountain, south end of the Salt Lake Valley, that had over 0.25 inches of moisture. So we're seeing a little bit of moisture. It's hit and miss, unfortunately, with the way these storms have been moving in and with the projection of how they're kind of spotty, if not isolated, into the afternoon. It's going to be, again, hit and miss, and who sees actual moisture precipitation throughout the day today and tomorrow. But, yeah, really there's no significant weather makers or precipitation makers for the entire state really in store just yet. We'll kind of have to keep our eye out for a good storm.
Yep. Okay, Nate, thanks, and have a good weekend.
You too.
Good morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour. This is Roger Goldman. Coming up, I'll be speaking with John Stevenson and Hillary Gilson of the Kimball Arts Center about the upcoming Arts Fest. Then we get to have our monthly conversation with Lauren Gustis, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Been a little news going on this week in Utah, and we'll discuss some of the more interesting stories. We're going to finish our hour with Derek Sitaway, the Summit County Communications Director. He'll have an update on the Dicker Hill Fire. Stay tuned. Well, I suppose it wouldn't be Friday if we didn't have the KPCW Friday Film Review. Fresh from the 2024 Sundance Film Festival, writer-director Sean Wang's debut feature, Dee Dee, is a coming-of-age story set in the early 2000s. Making its way to theaters this weekend, Linda Jager shares a review in the Friday Film Review.
2024 has been a banner year for filmmaker Sean Wang. His heartwarming documentary about his grandmothers, Nai Nai and Wai Po, was nominated for Best Documentary Short Oscar. At the same time, his debut feature, Dee Dee, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and won the U.S. Dramatic Audience Award and a special jury award for Best Ensemble. Among my favorites from this year's festival, Dee Dee was written, directed, and produced by Wang. It's a unique coming-of-age story set in the suburbs of California in 2008 about a 13-year-old Taiwanese-American boy named Chris, or Dee Dee, as he's known to his first-generation mother, played by Joan Chen, and his grandmother, played by Wang's real-life grandmother, Chang Li Hua. Chris, played by Isaac Wang, is in the throes of awkwardness in the summer between middle and high school. His older sister and adversary, Vivian, played by Sydney Chen, is heading off to college, and his father is largely absent as he works thousands of miles away in Taiwan to support his family in the United States. Navigating the pressures of his family's cultural expectations, school, and feelings of not fitting in, Chris becomes a bit of a rebel, alienating his middle school friends and gravitating to the older and much cooler skater kids. He's also experiencing his first crush crush on his classmate Maddie, played by Mihaela Park, which plays out on the social media platforms of the time, AOL, Instant Messenger, and MySpace. Wang cited the 1986 coming-of-age classic Stand By Me, which reminded him of him and his friends, as the inspiration for Dee Dee. Opening in theaters this weekend, Dee Dee is rated R and runs 1 hour and 34 minutes. Featuring strong performances from the ensemble cast and a tender and often funny story, Dee Dee is a film worth watching. This is Linda Jager with the KPCW Friday Film Review.
The National Ability Center has announced its new CEO. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Willie Ford is the National Ability Center's newly appointed CEO. The nonprofit aims to provide a safe, inclusive, and uplifting environment for people with disabilities through its adaptive sports programs. The center has been searching for a new leader since Dan Glasser announced his departure in October. In a news release, Board Chair David O'Brien said more than 100 applications were submitted and reviewed before the center decided on Ford. O'Brien said Ford was selected because of his connection to the center's mission and its vision for the future. Ford has lived in the Park City area for over 10 years and has over a decade of executive leadership experience in the outdoor and nonprofit industries. He served as vice chair of the High Fives Foundation, an adaptive sports nonprofit that provides resources for athletes. In an NAC video introducing Ford, he said he's thrilled to be in Park City serving 5,000 to 6,000 individuals each year.
My wife, son, and dog, we frequent the Round Valley area often, right in the National Ability Center's backyard. As we walk past the horses, I've said to my wife, if that CEO position ever opens up, that's an organization that I would be honored to lead.
Ford also co-founded the app GiveGo, which connects athletes with professionals for on-demand digital coaching. He also held leadership roles at an electric motorcycle organization called Cake and a company that manufactures helmets and other cycling and snow sport protection equipment. Ford took the helm at NAC this month. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
So, one of Wasatch County's most anticipated events of the year begins this weekend. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports Fair Days will include a rodeo, a livestock sale, a carnival, and more.
Wasatch County Parks and Recreation has a full calendar of events for this year's Fair Days. Festivities are planned from July 26th to August 3rd. The Demolition Derby will be on Friday and Saturday evenings at the Outdoor Arena on Southfield Road. Marketing coordinator Jennifer Bowman says the car crushing event is an exciting way to open the fair.
It's probably one of Heber's most coveted and favorite events of fair days. You know, it starts our fair days with a real bang. We have about 120 cars coming from all across the country. And tomorrow at 7 p.m. kicks off the first heat.
The highlight of next week's schedule is the Mountain Valley Stampede Rodeo, which is expected to draw professional riders. That's happening August 1st to the 3rd, and tickets are still available.
We have not seen the lineup yet. That's typically released week of, but we really see some fantastic cowboys and cowgirls. We have added money this year for each of our events, which is a huge draw.
The Mountain Valley Stampede Rodeo is sanctioned by the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. The total payout for this year's rodeo is about $160,000. This summer also features the Mountain Valley Roundup, formerly known as the Special Needs Rodeo, on August 2nd. About 100 people are expected to participate, and it's free for spectators. Fair days also include a skate competition, a carnival, vendors and exhibits, and 4-H livestock sales. Apart from the Demolition Derby and the rodeo, events are free for the public. For a full schedule, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Once a year, Main Street in Park City is turned into an incredible open-air art gallery. Here to talk about this year's Park City Kimball Arts Festival, we have Hillary Gilson, the festival director, and John Stevenson, the operations manager. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Something tells me you guys have been a little bit busy lately getting ready for the festival. So let's start with the basics. When does the festival start and what are the hours?
So yes, we have been just a little busy lately. The festival starts on August 2nd at 5 p.m. That's our locals night. And then runs through the weekend, so August 3rd and 4th. It ends at 6 p.m. on Sunday.
And you mentioned locals night. Let's remind our listeners, what is the arrangement for the locals?
So we offer free admission to Summit County locals on Friday night. You do have to register in advance online. So that's just something to remember to do before you arrive to the festival gates.
Okay. So how many artists are going to participate this year?
We have about 185 right now. There's always fluctuations close to the festival, but it will probably be around that number.
And how are they selected? How do artists get to participate in the festival?
So we have a open application process from November 1st through the middle of February. And then they're reviewed by a blind jury and selected and then invited to participate. So it's a really fun process to be a part of.
And you mentioned about 180 participate. About how many apply and are not allowed to be selected?
We have about 1,200.
Okay, so it is a fairly competitive.
Yep, so it's about 20% of artists that apply.
And just out of curiosity, how many, I know from year to year I go there, I see many of the same artists coming back year after year. What percentage are repeaters?
Oh, that's a great question. So recently we've been trying to make sure that there is turnover and that there's new artists on the street. So we make sure that there's at least 20% new artists. We also make sure that there's a minimum of 10 local artists, which is about 7 to 10% of the overall artist makeup, depending on the year.
And are there artists who are particularly successful? I mean, that sort of are there, let me put it this way, are there stars of the show?
Well, I think that's a really cool thing about the Kimball Arts Festival is that you get to be introduced to all of these new artists that you might not have seen before. So in my mind, the cool thing is, you know, you get to find the stars of your own show. We do, of course, have artists like Dolan Guymon, who's represented by Gallery Mar, Steve and Bonnie Harmston, who, you know, they do festivals across the country. They're probably in their, you know, 40th year of doing this. But then we also have amazing emerging artists like Jess Hugh. We have new artists to the street like Seth Smith this year in painting. So it's really a mix, and I encourage people to go out there and, yeah, like I said, find their own star.
And what are the range of media that you'll see at the festival?
So we have 13 different mediums. They range from sculpture and wood to printmaking and mixed media, digital art, kind of runs the whole gamut of art creation.
John, I know that putting on the show is a major logistical challenge. Talk to us a little bit about how long it takes you to get ready to do this and how complicated is it to get all these artists in and out of there?
It is quite complicated because it's such a, you know, the historic Main Street is so narrow, and we put in about 240 artist booths up and down the street. It's very tight, and we have a pretty tight timeline to get them in. We start Friday morning 3 a.m., close down the street. The artists start rolling in at 4 a.m.
Artists aren't usually up at that hour.
No.
That must be quite stressful for them.
There's a whole group that have figured out they can get in early and get on the street and start getting set up, and they have all day. Some of them have really amazingly elaborate booths that take them hours and hours to set up. And so they get in there early. We load in an artist every 5 minutes.
And do the artists, can they take vehicles down the street, or are they having to park in the alley and walk up?
They do both. Most mm-hmm. of them, we schedule them so that they take their vehicle onto Main Street, and they have from within anywhere from 2 hours to 1 hour to unload their vehicle and get out. So we sort of stair-step them backwards from downhill, and we have them, that's why it's so tightly scheduled. We literally have somebody every 5 minutes.
I'm visualizing a spreadsheet that has, you know, artist
yes.
number seven.
Many spreadsheets.
Right, yes. that has precise times.
Yes.
And given artists, I bet you have to work to keep them disciplined, to keep them on their schedules.
Yes, and you know, like, there's a lot of these artists are on a circuit, so they're coming
yeah.
from somewhere just before. They're going to pack up here Sunday night and go to the next one. So some of them are real pros. And some are not.
And John, in addition to all the artists that we'll see, are there other sort of things that you'll get to be able to see and do during the festival? Like, are there food? Is there music?
Oh, yes. Food, music. There are spirit gardens, one at Heber and Main, between Heber and Park and Main Street. There's a spirit garden. There's a stage there with music. There's a food sort of area up at the brew pub lot with food trucks and other vendors. A stage, another spirit garden. So there's all sorts of, and there's more.
Yeah, we also have a lot of Kimball Arts Center related programming. So this year we're really excited. We have the Young Artist Academy, the YAA program, which is a group of very talented teens. John's daughter I believe was a participant of it in a previous year. And so they will have a booth on Main Street. They will be selling their artwork. So that's really exciting. So definitely check out and support our student artists. We also have the Creation Station at Townliff Plaza and Studio on Main, which will be at Heber Main Intersection and at Miners Park. We'll be doing wheel throwing on Saturday, which is always a crowd favorite. So definitely make sure to check that out.
Okay, so tell us what happens at the Creation Station.
So the Creation Station, it's filled with youth-based activities. This year we'll have 2 paid activities and then 3 free activities for for kids to participate in and their parents. The 2 paid activities, they're $3 each or 2 for $5. And they include a take-home art item. So we're really excited to bring that onto the festival. And then we also have student art murals that are placed in front of the post office. Those were created by Kimball Art Center students. And new this year, we are partnering with Ship Utah. They are a shipping company based out of Holiday, and they their expertise is in artwork shipping. So they'll be in the post office parking lot shipping artwork on site. So if you're looking to ship something to California or maybe it's just a really big piece and you'd like it to be shipped and you don't want to deal with it for the rest of the festival, they can do that on site for you. So we're really excited to offer that for both our artists and our attendees this year.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't go back and ask you, what's wheel throwing?
Wheel throwing, thank you. So wheel throwing is a form of ceramics. So we have hand building demonstrations and we also have wheel throwing. So that's when you see the person making a bowl or a plate or a vase on the wheel. So we'll be doing hands-on demonstrations at Miners Park for that. So if you don't know what wheel throwing is, definitely come check it out. It's really fun, and it's a really dynamic and engaging way to participate in art making.
So I know that the artists are obvious here to try to sell their works, but is there also a competition and are there awards?
Yes, there are. So we do Best in Show Awards every year. So we have, I believe it's 16. So we do one for each medium. And then we also do an overall artist, a emerging artist, and a local artist. Those artists receive awards on Saturday night. So definitely make sure to come out to the festival on Sunday to check out who won. And you know, it's always fun just to see kind of what like the pinnacle of each medium would be at the arts festival. And they also receive automatic entrance to our, or automatic acceptance to our next year's festival.
So I realize that the Arts Fest is certainly not the ski swap, but there's a tendency in the ski swap on Sunday for prices to get cut. Have you seen a similar phenomenon here at the Arts Festival?
I have in my experience. It's up to each individual artist of what they want to offer on Sundays. But as a local to Park City, I would definitely recommend checking it out on Sunday and seeing what you can get.
Okay, so let's talk about sort of the financial aspects of the festival. First of all, do you have any sense of roughly what the gross sales are during the Arts Fest to the artists?
Oh, yeah. So last year, we cleared $2 million for artist sales over the course of the weekend. And to be clear, all of that money goes to the artists. So Kimball Art Center, what is considered funds raised for the Kimball Art Center would be ticket sales, sponsorships, vendors participating, but all artist sales, those go directly to the particular artist.
That's really interesting. You don't take a commission like the art galleries do.
We do not, no.
Okay. And then how many volunteers does it take to put on the show?
Volunteers are definitely the backbone of the arts festival. It takes, I think we have over 500 volunteer shifts, over 300 individual volunteers. We've already had quite a bit of volunteer shifts going on, and we're about 70% full for the course of the weekend, so we're definitely looking to fill some critical spots. And you guys can find some more information about signing up to be volunteers at KimballArtsFestival.org.
John, are most of the volunteer spots left, the ones at 3 and 4 in the morning during the load-in?
I think it maybe tend to be the afternoon shifts and Sunday shifts, so if you have some time in like Sunday afternoon, please volunteer.
Okay. And again, information about how to volunteer can be found on your website?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's correct. Yep. KimballArtsFestival.org.
Okay. So now we've talked about how much the artists raise. Let's talk about how much you raise. How important, what do you typically raise with this, and how important is the festival to the financial operations of the arts, of the Kimball Arts Center?
Yeah, the so it varies year to year. Like I said, it's really based on sponsorships, on artist booth sales, on tickets. But we raise quite a considerable amount of money for the Kimball Arts Center, and it is a crucial fundraiser for us throughout the year. It helps us have year-round programming for student artists, whether that be tots or teens or adult artists. It also helps us just with our general operating costs as well. So it's a very critical fundraiser for the Kimball Arts Center.
Now, we've gone out of our way to talk about how locals can obtain sort of a free admission if they register. Let's talk about the other end of the spectrum. I know you offer VIP packages and other kinds of premium options. Can you explain those to us?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, we do have daily tickets available as well. So those are $12 for adults and $6 for kids, 6 to 17, if you buy before August 1st. On August 2nd, those will increase to $15 and $7 for adults and kids. And then we do have VIP passes available. We have two types. The full VIP pass gives you full access to the festival, full reign of the VIP lounge, and that's $299. Then we also have weekender passes available, which have select access to the VIP lounge and a cash bar, and those are $99 for the whole weekend. I think it's a pretty great steal, so I would definitely recommend heading over to our website and picking up one of those.
And what's in the VIP lounge?
The VIP lounge has tons of great stuff. So we have tastings from various local breweries and wineries, also distilleries, and then we have tons of engaging activities. We're partnering with Sydney Garber this year, also Flowers for You, Mountain Wine Storage. So we've got really engaging aspects in the VIP lounge. There's also air conditioning and a great view of Main Street. And then Top Shelf also has a private bar in the VIP lounge. So it's just a nice way to kind of take a break and really enjoy yourself at the festival, you know, off of Main Street, but just kind of, you know, that bird's eye view.
Which
right
building
above.
Is it in?
Oh, thank you for mentioning that. It's at the Kimball Terrace. So the entrance is right off of Heber Ave. So you have a great, you get to overlook the main stage on Heber. And it's just a really nice experience for the weekend.
Anything else you want to add before we go?
I think we covered most of it. I think the last thing I want to add is that this year we are doing a new kind of coffee with Kimball, we're calling it. So at the Brass Bear Gate on Sunday morning at 10 a.m., we'll have bagels and coffee for our attendees to have while supplies last. And the first 100 people will receive a limited edition travel coffee mug. So we're really excited to offer that to our Sunday attendees.
Okay, Hillary Gilson, the festival director, and John Stevenson, the operations manager for the Kimball Arts Festival. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be right back after this. Once a month, we are lucky to be joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's executive editor, Lauren Gustus. We certainly have a lot to talk about this week, Lauren.
Oh my gosh, we do, Roger. It's been busy.
Okay, let's start with the Olympics. The Tribune covered this last-minute wrinkle in the Utah bid. Can you try to explain that to our audience? Because it's interesting. I've talked to some people about it, and they're pretty confused.
Yeah, it's a great question. We've been so focused on us, right? Do we have the facilities? How much money is it going to cost Utah? And the left turn that was thrown into the process on the day that Utah was supposed to, you know, receive the Olympics, Salt Lake City was supposed to receive the Olympics, really had nothing to do with Utah. It had everything to do with bunch of swimmers from China, 23 swimmers from China. They tested positive for a banned performance-enhancing substance prior to the Tokyo Olympics in 2021. Nobody knew about the positive test until the New York Times and a German broadcaster called ARD reported on them in April. So none of these Chinese swimmers suffered repercussions for the positive test. They won 5 medals in Tokyo, including 3 golds, and 11 of them are also set to compete in Paris starting today. And so essentially, WADA, which is the entity that's got oversight over testing Olympians to make sure that they're clean, they're not using illegal substances, has been getting some pressure from the United States seats. So the United States is saying, look, you didn't do your job. We think that you should be looking more closely at this. We think that, you know, there should have been some repercussions for these Chinese swimmers. And, you know, we are going to push on this. And WADA said, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? Look, this is our job. You know, trust us to do our job. And the United States has essentially said, no, we're not going to do that. And so the U.S., the Utah Olympic Committee had to insert at the last minute some language into its bid that said it would respect WADA. But just this morning, the Tribune and Julie Jagg, who's in Paris this week, she's our Olympics reporter, along with Robert Gerke, one of our politics reporters, said this morning, they reported this morning in a story we just published today, that leaders of a powerful congressional committee are not backing down on their investigation into the Chinese doping scandal. And they say it is not appropriate for the International Olympic Committee to threaten removing Salt Lake City as a 2034 host as leverage, right? So they've just doubled down. So we have 10 years to figure this out, right, in that the Olympics aren't set to come to Utah since, and obviously until 2034. However, things are not looking like they're going in the correct direction in terms of collaboration or respect amongst entities as we look at, you know, where things ultimately may land between WADA and, you know, the U.S. investigators who are interested in looking into whether or not WADA really did its job and held these Chinese swimmers to account. So I hope that helps. Nothing to do with Utah, everything to do with this spat between the, you know, the international agency that's charged with understanding and accounting, holding people to account for what drugs may or may not be used, right, in the Olympic sphere. And then in the United States, I think some hurt feelings around some Olympians who may not have gotten medals because they were competing against swimmers who were doping.
It's interesting. So Utah's kind of caught in a crossfire that they really have nothing to do with. The Utah Olympic Committee has no power here to do anything about this.
It does not.
Okay. And as a practical matter, as we see this, for lack of a better term, shooting match between these entities, as time goes by, is there really a possibility that they could move the game somewhere else? I mean, if they don't do, it seems to me this is almost a lot of political posturing by everybody.
That's my take too, Roger. You know, I'm not an expert. You're not an expert, respectfully,
sure.
Right? And so, you know, we'll see how things unfold. The congressional members that are fired up that we reported on today have several demands. They want a detailed timeline of WADA's response to the Chinese swimmers. They want to know who at WADA decided to accept China's explanation, which was that the food that the Chinese athletes ate was tainted in the kitchen where they were staying, and that was the result, that positive tests were a result of that. They want WADA's communication and records about the controversy, and they want to know what is being done to build trust in WADA going forward. So I don't know that they'll get all those things, but those aren't, you know, hey, we're going to you know, continue to prosecute and move down our own path on this, right? We'll see where things land with respect to WADA and, you know, the United States' interest in these Chinese swimmers. But to your point, there aren't many cities that can effectively host a Winter Olympics. And my guess is our congressional leadership knows that, right? And they've got some leverage here in terms of being able to say, look, we need you to be better in this space. Here's how. I don't know what the IOC will do, but it would be a quite shocking turn of events if the IOC were to pull the games from Salt Lake, in part because there are just so few options exactly with respect to where they may be awarded, if not Salt Lake.
Of course, it's also hard to visualize exactly what legislation the congressional committees are seeking to figure out how to use by doing this investigation, but I suppose that's neither here nor there.
Well, that actually, sorry, does exist. So there is legislation that was passed in 2020 or 2019, I can't remember which, that enables the United States, it gave itself the authority to look into these matters. It's called the, I'm going to get this wrong, Roger, because I'm not a radio person, I'm a print person, the Rodchenkov Anti-Doping Act. Passed in 2020, it allows U.S. law enforcement to crack down on international doping schemes and prosecute foreign citizens running them if they affect U.S. athletes or sponsors. So the U.S. has self-awarded itself the authority to do this already.
Well, we'll keep following this story if and when it continues to develop. Another trip story that I found interesting focused on the issue of ticket prices and the availability of tickets to Utah residents. Can you talk a little bit about what the committee's saying?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. I think in that, like, okay, the doping issue may or may not really matter to you or me at the end of the day. It is likely to be resolved and the Olympics will come to Utah. But tickets are one of the primary ways that we can connect with the Olympics, right? Obviously, volunteering is another significant opportunity, and Utah's got a lot of ideas and a lot of plans there. But the U.S. Olympic Committee, specifically the Utah Committee, is very interested in how it can ensure Utahns have an opportunity to go to the Games, right? And so while the Utah Olympic Committee has said that ticket revenue should cover a third of the $4 billion bill for putting on the Winter Games, which is not an insignificant sum, right? It is looking to allocate a whole bunch of tickets to Utahns. So what does that mean? Well, specifically, it says it's got around 8 million tickets to be sold, right? And it's going to set aside 40% of those for Utahns. They will be allocated by a lottery, just as they were in 2002, and they will be, some of them, relatively affordable. So they're allocating 34,000 tickets at a price tag of just $34 each, right, to celebrate the 2034 Olympics. So the organizing committee is really thinking, I think, ahead of time about how to engage people, how to involve them, how to ensure they have access to the games, right? And that makes a lot of sense because we're the ones that will bear the brunt of whatever disruption it may be that are coming to our communities. The other thing they are going to do, and we'll hear more about this, I'm sure, in the months and years to come, is be very proactive around how folks can volunteer. And those volunteerism efforts, yes, while they're focused on the 2 weeks that the games are here and then the Paralympics following, are also going to have longer lead times, right? Folks will be engaged sooner. One of the things that has been really important to Fraser Bullock, who's essentially leading the Utah bid, is that these games leave a lasting impact on our community. He's very focused on unity and how we can build community through the Olympics. And so he believes that making tickets available, making volunteer opportunities available are two primary ways to be able to do that.
You know, in the 20-some-odd years since the last games we had here, the way in which tickets for major sporting events are priced have changed dramatically. And what you're seeing is this huge differential between the better tickets and the worst tickets. As I believe there was a quote about from Fraser Bullock about being unabashed about how some of these tickets are going to be really, really expensive.
Yeah, he said essentially that they're going to package them with like a bigger sponsorship opportunity, right? And so they are going to try to make as much profit as they can on the really expensive ones. He said, we will be unapologetic that there's going to be some really expensive tickets, but they're combined, he said, with hospitality, right? The tents, the receptions, the parties, and so on and so forth. And then he follows that up by saying, then we're going to have some really inexpensive tickets, right? And so if, I think Julie, our reporter, did a nice sweep in the story that she's got, which you can find on sltrip.com, that shows just how much tickets are going for in Paris starting this week. So high-end seats for gymnastics this week are priced at 650 euros, right? The max price for a seat at the men's basketball gold medal game, most expensive event of the Paris Olympics, was 980 euros. So obviously, you know, that's not attainable for a lot of people. But I think that Utah seems to be focused on, okay, how can we create as much opportunity for as many people as possible such that they can attend by allocating that percent of, you know, Utah tickets to Utahns.
It'll be interesting to see how much tickets like that are going for on the secondary market in Paris as well. And Julie's fortunate enough to be there. Maybe she can figure that out for us. Anything else you want to touch on the Olympics before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, Roger, but I'm a journalist and we're taught to be skeptical, right? And to make sure that we ask the hard questions and we consider every angle. And I do think that there's a lot of hard questions that we will continue to ask in the next 10 years, right? If you remember the 2002 games, were built on a bribery scandal. And we had a lot of cleanup work to do in the middle of those games such that, you know, we ensured the process was clean moving forward. You know, I do think economic impact is something we'll continue to look at. The Gardner Center said that, you know, there'll be a $6.6 billion economic impact from these games. I want to continue to test those numbers. I want to make sure that, you know, we're doing our due diligence as an accountability accountability-rooted organization here. But I will say, as a human, it's been really fun to follow the Olympics announcement this week, to see everybody down in Washington Square celebrating at 3 a.m. in the morning on Pioneer Day. And I hope that the next 10 years are filled with, you know, anticipation of a good kind, because it's a great thing.
And as you also mentioned, we here in Utah will bear the brunt of the disruption. One would hope that, as part of the economic impact you're talking about, that infrastructure improvements, to the extent that they could be made with funding, would be one of the benefits that we see. And I'm sure you guys are following that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think the pie in the sky, and then there, to my knowledge, there are no plans for this, is some sort of, you know, public transit option from Salt Lake City to Park City. But right now they're looking at just extending, you know, some of the public transit that was already built into for 2002, right? The tracks lines and so on and so forth. So yes, we're watching that closely. We continue to keep an eye on it. Also continue to keep an eye on air quality and what Utah may or may not do to try to rehabilitate our reputation, if you will, ahead of, you know, the world essentially arriving on our doorstep. It would be quite a bummer if, you know, we were all breathing in some pretty bad air as folks arrive in February 2034.
Okay, so the biggest story in national politics this week obviously involved the withdrawal of Joe Biden from the presidential race. The Tribune covered the reactions of several Utah political figures to the emergence of Vice President Harris. What were they saying?
Yeah, well, great question. The Democrats, I'm sure it will come as no surprise, were supportive. They moved fairly quickly to support her, Kamala Harris, that is, at the Democratic convention, which is coming up next month. So, you know, really drama-free, you know, as we've seen all across the country, you know, pretty quick support for Harris from that constituency. Everybody issued statements on Sunday over the days following, you know, President Biden's announcement on Sunday of last week, or just this week, I suppose. And the Republicans have predictably been less than supportive. I can't say I fully understand what their responses have been. Burgess Owens said that Kamala Harris is the epitome of DEI. In a quote in the Punchbowl News earlier this week. It wouldn't be on me to interpret what that is, but I would imagine that he meant it in a less than supportive way. And Mike Lee has really been hammering her on Palestine and Israel as Netanyahu was in town and she met with him yesterday or 2 days ago, forgive me. And as there have been a lot of protests throughout, you know, the city, Washington, D.C., on either side of the war, the Israel-Hamas war. So that's where his focus seems to be, at least over the last few days on Twitter. I can't say that, you know, either one of them are fans, but the Democrats in Utah have, as you would imagine, you know, thrown their support behind Harris, as Democrats have in many other states across the country.
Now, Tony, we only have a couple minutes left, but Tony Semerad had a really interesting story on the revitalization of downtown Salt Lake and the role of the sports district. What needs to happen to make what is labeled as Utah's living room a vibrant area for visitors and residents?
Yeah, that's a great story. There's a lot going on there, and I would say the Tribune has really dedicated itself to owning it, right, in that we've put a team of reporters, including sports and news and Cityside, together to make sure that we're on top of it, because it is moving fast, right? And so the city's got a big vote coming up with respect to whether or not it will accept a half a point sales tax for essentially to fund any number of the projects that folks want to see come to fruition downtown. And that's the first big hurdle, right, is will Salt Lake City approve the 0.5% sales tax, which will result in, you know, tens of millions of dollars going towards the project every year for the next, I can't remember, it's 20 or 30 years, and I should know that. The legislature has to approve the plan. It has final sign off, final say. Obviously, Ryan Smith and Smith Entertainment Group are deep involved. Ryan Smith would like to take three blocks and build out an entertainment district. There's some uncertainty with respect to what happens to Abravanel Hall, right, which is a beloved, music space downtown, and lots of folks I know come, for example, from Park City up here.
She's gone. Okay, we've been speaking with Lauren Gustus. I guess we're not going to know what the current thinking is on what's going to happen to Abravanel Hall. That's something that we have been following and will continue to follow. Lauren, thanks for joining us. If you can hear me, we'll be right back after this. So the Dicker Hill fire has been burning outside of Colville for the last day or so. I know we had a little bit of rain last night, but here with an update on the status of that fire is Summit County Communications Director Derek Sidaway. Derek, thanks for calling in this morning.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. And how happy is it? Where do things stand in terms of that fire?
Well, we have some pretty good news. Things are looking good. So as many parts of the county did, the fire received some rain last night. The plan is that over this weekend, the Type 3 incident management team will transition to a Type 4 team or a local team. And yeah, the containment remained at 55% this morning. We're still looking at 361 acres. So no change in containment, but no growth to the fire. And yeah, with the precipitation we received last night, things are looking good.
And how close did the fire get to residences or other buildings?
So there was one structure in the area. There was a single home there. My understanding was that individual wasn't home at the time, but they would have been evacuated if they were. And that was more of a precaution. I don't have any exact distances. I know that there were fire apparatus parked at that individual's home the first night of the fire, just as a precaution. But the fire didn't get within any immediate threatening distance of that structure.
And by the way, you mentioned moving from a Type 3 to a Type 4. Just so our listeners can understand, what are those differences?
So the Type 3 team is a state-managed team. That's typically when you have as a fire grows larger and more resources than what are available locally are needed, a Type 3 team can be ordered and they'll come in from the state and provide additional resources. The Type 4 team is the local team, the fire districts that we have here that would handle a fire initially and then transition back to a fire as it scales back down.
And what is known about the cause of the fire?
So at this time, the fire was determined to be human caused. However, any details related to that are still pending a final report from the fire investigator. So aside from determining and announcing that the fire was human caused, we don't have any additional information at this time.
So human caused means it's something other than lightning. In other words, it's somebody did something, basically.
Yes, it was not caused by lightning. That's correct.
Okay, but we don't know. Okay, and obviously that's something that you'll be following up on. So Derek, it's been dry here for a while. I know we had a little bit of rain last night. How serious is the fire danger this summer given our dry conditions?
So we are seeing things are very dry, and as far as the actual fire level warning in Summit County, it is at extreme, which is the highest level. It's hard to say compared to other years. We've certainly had worse years. You know, we've received some decent winters the past couple of years, and we're not in a drought status right now. However, we are still seeing fuels drying out, which they do every year at this time. We're still looking at probably a month and a half to 2 months of summer and fire season. So even when we get some of this monsoon rain coming in, what we want people to know is fire conditions, things are still dry, fire conditions are still extreme in the county, and that we would ask you to, again, we have a fireworks ban, and as we're coming out of the 24th of July, that fireworks time when they can be used legally anyway is ending. But we would tell people with their other activities that could cause a fire, to use caution, to be extremely careful, especially around dry vegetation.
Okay.
So things aren't necessarily worse than average, but just what we naturally deal with here every year, there's definitely, it's appropriate to use an abundance of caution around some of our dry fuels, especially those grasses as they start to turn brown and they've been growing tall this year and over the past 2 years with the amount of moisture we've been receiving.
Okay, Derek, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, just to, again, wrap up, we encourage people to use what the state calls fire scent, so just an abundance of precaution. And then also for Summit County residents and visitors and those interested, if you'd like to receive local fire updates from the county via text, you can subscribe to our alerts for that by texting SC Fire Info. So that's all one keyword, SC Fire Info, to 888-777.
Okay, Derek, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. The Christian Center of Park City is asking locals to support the Back to School Basics program. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Back to School Basics was created to ensure local kids have access to enough clothing and school supplies each year. Each child who signs up receives a $100 gift card to spend at the outlets Park City, now called Junction Commons Park City. The kids also get to choose a new backpack and school supplies. Over 1,300 Summit and Wasatch County students have registered for the 2024 school year, about the same number the program served in 2023. According to Center CEO Rob Harder, $100,000 is needed to provide supplies to every child. In a video, Harder said the center welcomes any support locals can give.
In the past, some people have given $1,000, for example, to sponsor 10 kids. Or you can give more, $2,000, and sponsor 20 kids. Whatever you feel comfortable with, whatever you're able to do, we appreciate any and all gifts to just make sure all these students have the opportunity to go shopping for this school year.
The center also needs donated school supplies. Boxes decorated with Back to School Basics flyers have been placed in locations across Park City for anyone to drop off supplies. Locals can also buy supplies from the center's Amazon wish list. Kids will be at Junction Commons on August 6th and 7th to buy supplies. Volunteers are needed to support the event. A link to sign up can be found at kpcw.org. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Midway leaders plan to work with Heber City Police Department to add a regular law enforcement presence in the town. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the details.
Midway has never had a police department. Instead, county first responders answer 911 calls and city employees do day-to-day code enforcement. But that could soon change. Midway council members said at their meeting July 16th they want to negotiate a contract with Heber Police to implement a patrol presence. This comes after months of consideration. Council members identified law enforcement as a priority during their annual retreat in January. Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson says the town listed specific police service needs, including patrolling and parking and trail use enforcement. In town, speeding is the main issue.
Our biggest dilemma that we're faced with really in Midway is cars going too fast in our very quiet 25-mile-an-hour streets. It's consistently the number one cause of concern when citizens reach out to me.
Children and teens on e-bikes and motorized scooters are another concern.
We have a real influx this year, particularly of underage use of motorized and electric vehicles like motorcycles and scooters and things like that on our roads, and it's unsafe. We've had some close calls.
Leaders say it makes sense for city employees to continue doing code enforcement as usual rather than asking police officers to take over that duty. Heber Police Chief Parker Sever says two officers would be assigned to Midway so the community recognizes them.
If we are to get this contract, you know, one of the things that we'll be doing is Midway will become a beat. And so they should see the same officers every day that are responding to the calls for service.
Those officers will be on duty during the day shifts. At night, the Sheriff's Department would continue to answer calls as they do now. Council members asked Johnson to work with Midway City Attorney and Heber Police to negotiate a contract. Sever estimates the first year of service will cost Midway about $440,000, including salaries, equipment, and training for two officers. After the first year, the cost will drop to about $395,000. That's because the department will hire two new officers to maintain the same level of service in Heber while expanding patrol coverage into Midway. Johnson says city staff adjusted the budget with that price tag in mind, so citizens won't pay extra taxes for the police service. Council members say they want to begin with a one-year trial and renew the contract annually after that. They want the plans to remain flexible if services from the Wasatch County Sheriff's Department become a better option in the future. Next, Sever must get approval from the Heber City Council to move forward in negotiations with Midway. Then, both city councils must approve the contract. Johnson says she's hopeful the Midway City Council will be able to approve a contract at its meeting August 20th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Park City Area Lodging Association reports minimal impacts to area tourism after airlines canceled and delayed many flights last week. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
PCALA Board President Rob Alday of Abode Luxury Rentals says hotel and rental operators he's spoken with didn't have many guests miss reservations.
Like two or three people here or there, but like, you know, out of 50 or 100 arrivals, it's not a huge thing.
That's despite major upheaval in the travel industry nationwide. Cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike took responsibility for a global IT outage late July 18th, saying one of its updates crashed Microsoft Windows on any machine that received it. The outage impacted flight schedules, particularly at Delta Airlines. NPR reports Delta is still canceling hundreds of flights daily. And the Federal Department of Transportation is investigating why the Atlanta-based carrier was so hard hit. Although Salt Lake City International Airport is a Delta hub, Park City-bound travelers have been mostly fine. Alday attributes that to the seasonality of mountain tourism. When Southwest canceled flights during the 2022 holiday season, it coincided with the ski season.
Southwest, you do have a lot of feeder markets from Vegas and Phoenix and some California areas, and so that was a big effect in the winter, and it's just the volume thing.
Some hotels using Microsoft systems did report outages, but CrowdStrike prepared a software fix. In many cases, the repair required someone to physically connect to the affected computer, manually undo the faulty update, then reboot it. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up on Monday on Mountain Money, author Sarah Franklin will discuss her new book, The Editor, which profiles publishing legend Judith Jones. She was the woman who pushed her publishing house to publish The Diary of Anne Frank and later promoted the career of Julia Child with her Art of French Cooking book. Then we'll speak with Oni Baldock about Walhalla, and we'll finish our hour with Dina Stewart, the co-owner of Mathnasium in Kimball Junction.